content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the April 14th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. From the books section, James C. Scott and the Art of Resistance. The late political scientist enjoined readers to look for opposition to authoritarian states not in revolutionary vanguards, but in acts of quiet disobedience, by Nikhil Saval. In Praise of Floods, published by Yale, a study of rivers by the late political scientist James C. Scott arrives after a year of catastrophic floods. Last spring, heavy rainfall lifted parts of the San Jacinto and Trinity Rivers in East Texas, at least a dozen feet above the flood stage, forcing thousands to evacuate their homes. In September, during Hurricane Helene, the French Broad River surged into commercial corridors in Asheville, North Carolina, wiping out restaurants, breweries, stores, and dwellings. In October, in Spain, the Magro, Júcar, and Turia rivers overflowed their banks in the region around the city of Valencia, leading to the deaths of 232 people. Scott wants us to look past disasters such as these. Focusing on the human costs of flooding, he argues, is too anthropocentric. A flood may be, for humans, the most damaging of natural disasters worldwide, but from a long-run hydrological perspective, it is just the river breathing deeply as it must. A seasonal inundation, known as a flood pulse, delivers crucial nutrients to organisms that depend on rivers. Without the annual occupation of the floodplain, the channel, that line on the map, is comparatively dead biotically, he argues, or, as he puts it more succinctly elsewhere in the book, no flood, no river. It is as difficult to imagine a flood survivor reading these sentences without objection as it would be to picture a displaced resident of Pacific Palisades reading a book called In Praise of Fires. But Scott doesn't ignore how damaging a river's overflowing can be to those living along its banks. In celebrating periodic flooding, he is also warning about the costs of human intervention. Dams and levees lead to less frequent flooding, but erosion and deforestation mean more catastrophic floods when these barriers are breached. The more civilized you are, the less resilient you are. In Praise of Floods offers a posthumous conclusion to a scholarly career of upending conventional wisdom. Scott spent 45 years in the political science department at Yale, where he taught until a few years before his death, last July, at 87. But his interests were broader than those of most political scientists. He started out as a specialist in contemporary Southeast Asia. Just as he was beginning to gain recognition for his work, he risked his career to move to Malaysia and embark upon an ethnography of village life. He founded the Agrarian Studies program at Yale, researching and teaching about rural communities from around the world. By the end of his career, he had left detailed fieldwork behind and was writing sweeping treatments of the distant past, which nonetheless managed to broach some of the most vexing political questions of our time. Though Scott came from the political left, his most famous book, Seeing Like a State, a vigorous critique of big government projects intended to improve human welfare, was warmly received by the libertarian right. When asked to define himself, he hedged and qualified. He sometimes called himself a crude Marxist with the emphasis on crude. He was an anthropologist by courtesy, in acknowledgement of the fact that he had no formal training in the discipline. Late in life, he drifted toward anarchism, but even this belief system exerted a tenuous hold, and he could offer only two cheers for it. He strove to cultivate a similar openness in his students. For several years at Yale, he led what he called an incubator workshop, in which he encouraged graduate students to bring in half-formulated ideas as a way to develop risk-taking instincts. Another risk he encouraged was student organizing. He was a strong and consistent supporter of the decades-long project to form a graduate student union at Yale. In his private life, he tried his hand at farming. His biography on the political science department's website listed him as a, quote, mediocre farmer, end quote. And he brought eggs to his classes. The lives of people working in agriculture were at the center of Scott's work. Small farmers and peasants the world over endured dramatic transformations in the 20th century and were subject to grand and ill-begotten experiments by capitalist and communist states alike. In colonial and post-colonial regimes, they were forced to plant cash crops and were heavily taxed. Under Stalin and Mao, experiments in collective farming led to famine. Scott wanted to study how rural populations responded to these upheavals. Peasants have often been seen as docile and passive. He looked out for tacit local knowledge that states ignored in their giant programs of social remodeling, and discerned in small acts of disobedience a pattern of resistance that sometimes erupted into full-scale revolt. In his later work, he cheerfully depicted the barbarians who hovered on the edges of states, eluding conscripted labor and leading daring raids on grain hordes. Scott himself was a bit like one of those barbarians, constantly attacking and unsettling a seemingly stable consensus on the value of state power and of civilization itself. Scott first visited Southeast Asia in his early 20s. Born in southern New Jersey in 1936, he attended a Quaker school before going to Williams College. At Williams, a professor encouraged him to study Burma, now Myanmar. After graduating, Scott went there on a Rotary Fellowship in 1959. Riding a 1940 Triumph motorcycle, he traveled throughout the country, ending up at Mandalay University, where he studied Burmese for 5 months. The sojourn launched his interest in Southeast Asia, the peasantry, and the formation of states. While overseas, Scott wrote reports on Burmese student politics for the CIA and was involved in the U.S. National Student Association, then a hotbed of global student activism. As detailed by the political scientist Karen Paget, Scott's involvement with the CIA was brief, but his time with the USNSA seems to have whetted his interest in radical politics. This was the era of Third Worldism, when countries that had ejected colonial powers began to band together, many of them under the banner of non-aligned socialism. With the USNSA, Scott traveled to Singapore, where he met representatives of the Socialist Student Union, and to Indonesia, where he was introduced to the heads of the Communist Student Union, many of whose members were later killed in the country's anti-communist purges of 1965. In the 1960s and 70s, the Vietnam War was a matter of urgent concern in politics and scholarship alike. The leading role played in the war by the Vietnamese rural poor prompted Scott to wonder what motivated peasants to revolt. This question led to his first major book, The Moral Economy of the Peasant, from 1976, which borrowed the idea of a moral economy from the left-wing British historian E.P. Thompson. Scott described a universe of mutual assistance that peasants, his subject was Southeast Asia, but his conclusions were general, created for themselves to ensure that they didn't go hungry. The peasantry relied on what Scott called a subsistence ethic, a safety-first principle that dictated that access to food and other means of sustaining life took precedence over maximizing profit. If this fragile web of economic relationships was disturbed, it could lead to starvation and a breakdown of social trust. Just such a breakdown had occurred in Vietnam and Burma in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when colonial authorities began to intrude into peasant life, privatizing village lands, forests, and fisheries, and introducing a multitude of punishing taxes. These moves disrupted the tenuous balance that had allowed peasants to survive. when the Great Depression reached these countries in 1930, putting further strain on the livelihoods of small farmers, they erupted in resistance. Crowds, sometimes swelling to the thousands, began an assault on the colonial state. In a series of rebellious actions in central Vietnam, Scott writes, quote, administrative offices and their tax rolls were destroyed, post offices and railroad stations and schools were burned, alcohol warehouses plundered, collaborating officials assassinated, forest guard posts destroyed, rice stores seized, and at least one salt convoy attacked, end quote. The moral economy of the peasant came out as political events were laying waste to the hopes that many had placed in Third World Revolution. Post-colonial and socialist states, founded in opposition to colonial oppression, exhibited their own brutality and oppressiveness. One country after another employed fantastic schemes to improve general welfare, such as Mao's Great Leap Forward and the Tanzania campaign to resettle rural populations in planned villages. These efforts often required coerced labor and diminished democratic participation, and sometimes led to famine. When peasant rebellions appeared, they were crushed, even in superficially democratic countries such as India, whose government violently suppressed the Naxalite uprisings in West Bengal. Later in life, Scott would confess to having become disillusioned by the way in which revolutions produced a stronger state that was more oppressive than the one it replaced. Scott's fourth book, The Extraordinary Weapons of the Weak, from 1985, registers a growing disenchantment with revolutionary politics. In 1978, hoping to observe peasant struggle up close, he had moved with his wife Louise and their three children from Connecticut to a remote village in the state of Kedah, the rice bowl of Malaysia. In that country, as elsewhere in Southeast Asia, revolutionary idealism was giving way to forms of state power that were sometimes as intrusive as the colonial regimes that they had replaced. As part of the so-called Green Revolution, the Malaysian government had introduced new machinery and cash crops intended to boost agricultural productivity, restructuring the farming economy in ways that were greatly resented by the rural poor. Scott went to Malaysia looking for rebellion, but instead of open defiance, he found a series of half-measures, quote, foot-dragging, dissimulation, desertion, false compliance, pilfering, feigned ignorance, slander, arson, sabotage, end quote. Outward conformity and deference on the part of the poor masked quiet subterfuge. Villages were squatting on land that belonged to others, stealing food and money, refusing to work or working more slowly than usual, and secretly damaging farm machines. A man in Kedah told Scott that he knew exactly how to put barbed wire and nails into an auger to jam a combine harvester. He recounted watching as other villages surrounded a harvester belonging to a Chinese syndicate, poured kerosene over the engine and the cab, and set it on fire. Scott defined these actions as everyday resistance and argued that this was the most common form assumed by the fight against an oppressive society. Organized revolt was rare, but public servility masking private resentment was everywhere. There is a certain doomed quality to the activity Scott describes in Weapons of the Weak. The peasants in Kedah knew that they had no way to win their campaign against the state. They hoped only to minimize or delay the threat to their livelihoods. Scott came to think, however, that such muted protests were in fact more common and more important than any other kind, and that these actions had the potential to bring down governments. In a later work, he named this sort of a rebellion infrapolitics, politics outside the visible range. Throughout world history, he argued, people fought the encroachment of state power not by public protest, which under an authoritarian regime often meant death, but through a series of clandestine activities that amounted to protest nonetheless. In Domination and the Arts of Resistance, published in 1990, He told the story of how, as 18th century European states began taking control of forests previously held in common, the peasantry in England and France continued to forage in them and gather firewood and pasture animals, even after these activities had been outlawed. They considered it an injustice that their customary privileges had been abrogated by fiat. And they would fight, if quietly and subversively, rather than cede what they understood to be their rights. Scott's injunction to look for resistance where it does not immediately appear turns the familiar hierarchy of the visible and the invisible on its head. Don't look only at the operations of power, at the crushing machinery of the state, at the apparent acquiescence of people to being ruled, he seems to say. Look instead at things that don't seem worthy of comment at all. That is where the vast majority of resistance takes place. Look at rumors, gossip, metaphors, euphemisms, folktales, all the means by which subordinate groups disguise their opposition. This isn't just another way of submitting to power. This is a way of maintaining safety, of living to fight another day. And, Scott believed, slipping from the worlds of his peasant subject to something more universal, it is all around. Scott's sympathy for resistance to the state and his congenital skepticism of any project coming from on high constitute a political orientation that he eventually began to call anarchism. Unlike the late anthropologist David Graeber, one of the founding organizers of Occupy Wall Street, Scott was not an anarchist activist. He had long ceased to be involved with social movements, and he offered no strategic considerations. But he shared with Graeber a theoretical viewpoint that did not take for granted that civilization was a natural good. Much of human history occurred outside the context of states, and a good deal of it, if you abstracted the objects of your gaze through what Scott called an anarchist squint, took place in direct opposition to states. This meant that when you looked at how states worked, even when they were trying to improve human welfare, you often found that they ignored the very things that people did on their own, without the help of government, to maintain their existence or to live free of coercion. The subject of how government worked or failed to work was the focus of Seeing Like a State, a series of case studies of high modernist social engineering projects undertaken mostly in the course of the 20th century. Perhaps the book's most familiar example for Americans is that of the large-scale city planning to which the urbanist and writer Jane Jacobs objected. But Scott also looked at German scientific forestry, collective farming in the Soviet Union and Tanzania, utopian city planning in Chandigarh, India, and in Brasilia, and Vladimir Lenin's theories about the formation of revolutionary parties. Despite ideological differences, many 20th century intellectuals, politicians, and planners were united in their belief that the state had a special capacity to make vast improvements in human lives through wide-reaching social transformations. To accomplish such improvements, modern states had to reorder society in a way that was legible to them by bringing their subjects under centralized administrative control. How can the government collect taxes, for instance, or conscript soldiers or enforce the law, if people do not have last names? Better assign some. In a footnote drawn from a historical document, Scott unearths the example of a 16th century Welshman who was chastised by an English judge for giving his name in the Welsh fashion as Thomas Ap, son of William Ap Thomas, Ap Richard, Ap Ul, Ap Evan Vaughan. Afterward, the man called himself Mostyn, according to the name of his principal house, and left that name to his posterity. Seeing Like a State radiates with Scott's fondness for reversing hierarchies of knowledge. He insists that high modernist projects of social reform, however sophisticated their proponents, were less complex, not more, than the local societies and forms of knowledge they attempted to reorder. How much more detailed knowledge is concentrated in Thomas App William App Thomas App Richard App Hole App Evan Vaughan than in Thomas Molston? The vision that a planner and his state bureaucracy projected onto an agricultural area or a neighborhood was far more rigid and simplified than what already existed. Scott called the practical knowledge accumulated by locals metis, after the ancient Greek word for skill or wisdom, distinct from gnosis, the word related to our knowledge and insight. Metis was common sense, experience, a knack, or savoir-faire. It was the way, for example, that certain indigenous Americans taught colonial settlers to plant corn when the oak leaves were the size of a squirrel's ear, a folkloric aphorism that contained within it years of observation of the sequence of seasonal change. But metis was also the informal system of eyes on the street that Jane Jacobs observed as having developed over the years in dense urban neighborhoods, and which no project planned from on high could replicate. Metis was also the warren of narrow city streets, perhaps built over old cow paths, that both represented and generated a thick network of intimate and practical neighborly relationships. High modernism, on the other hand, was the grid, easier to survey, tax, and police. Seeing Like a State was published in 1998, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the decline of socialism, and after the United States had lost its taste for New Deal-style economic planning. Perhaps as a result, the book appeared more conservative than Scott meant it to be. The political science Francis Fukuyama gave it an approving notice in Foreign Affairs, and a year after it was published, the head of the Libertarian Cato Institute invited Scott to address its annual convention, much to his dismay. Many on the left concurred with their libertarian colleagues that Scott had made, however inadvertently, a pro-market case against state power. In a review, the liberal economist Brad DeLong noted that striking similarities in argument between Scott's brief against planning and the libertarian Austrian economist Hayek's praise of the spontaneous order of market economies. Scott, unlike Hayek, was an avowed skeptic of free markets. In Seeing Like a State, he had argued, albeit briefly, that market-driven standardization was susceptible to many of the flaws of modern social engineering. But his critics on the left were not wrong to compare his arguments to Hayek's. So intently and thoroughly did Scott make his case against the modern state that, once you've read Seeing Like a State, it is difficult to imagine the virtue of any state action, even of the incremental and meliorist variety. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? Years later, it is possible to look at Scott's book less as an isolated broadside against the state and more as a way of seeing, through extreme examples, the extent to which planning ignores local knowledge at its peril. Still, even in those instances, Scott offers equivocal lessons. When it comes to contemporary debates on how best to solve our nationwide housing crisis, for instance, he can be read as an ally to movements attempting to protect neighborhoods against large-scale development. He asks planners to, quote, prefer wherever possible to take a small step, stand back, observe, and then plan the next small move, end quote. He makes special pleas for, quote, context and particularity, end quote. At the same time, he asks to make room for human inventiveness and surprises, which might suggest removing constraints to development. For example, restrictive zoning that stifle initiative and drive. If you need room to build, better for the state to get out of the way. Both stances are conceivable within the capacious framework of the book, and that is perhaps why radicals and conservatives alike have found support for their arguments in its pages. Seeing like a state offers an even more complex or blurry lens through which to view the climate crisis. Scott's study of how states reorder the natural world to generate maximum revenue may help to explain our own landscapes of fracking pads and pipelines. But it's difficult to extract from the book a coherent strategy to fight climate change. To avoid the worst of the devastation from rising global temperatures will undoubtedly require not just state action, but multi-state cooperation on an unprecedented scale. Governments may need to override city and country alike to produce solar arrays and wind farms, shut down coal and gas-fired power plants, unearth minerals for large-scale battery storage, and retrofit millions of houses, offices, and schools with electric cooling and heating systems. With Scott in mind, it's possible to hope that states engaged in this collective project will overcome the blindness of the past. Still, if they and we are to succeed, Scott's advice that planners pause before making their next small move will likely be discarded. It's an irony of Scott's career that, though he pleaded for respecting local knowledge, his own writing began to take on imperial proportions in the later decades of his life. The last major works that he published before his death, The Art of Not Being Governed and Against the Grain, both cover centuries of history, confidently summing up many shelves worth of research and surveying wide tracts of geography. Scott examines how ancient states formed around sedentary agricultural practices, growing rice in medieval Southeast Asia and wheat in ancient Mesopotamia. Not because such farming had any intrinsic or inevitable value, but because it was an important step in creating a legible and manageable state. Outside the rice paddy state and grain states, in Scott's view, intrepid rebels engaged in more mobile, nomadic forms of agriculture, trying to escape taxation and forced labor. Scott saw each step in the civilizing process, from farming cereals to working on an assembly line, as a loss of complexity, a diminishing of the great diversity of natural rhythms to which our ancestors were attuned. "It is no exaggeration to say," he writes, before arguably risking such an exaggeration, "that hunting and foraging are, in terms of complexity, as different from cereal grain farming as cereal grain farming is, in turn, removed from repetitive work on a modern assembly line. Each step represents a substantial narrowing of focus and a simplification of tasks." From this perspective, a civilization's collapse, rather than something to be lamented, might be experienced, at least by those at the edge of a state, as an emancipation. Scott acknowledged that so-called dark ages offer, quote, "fewer important digs for archaeologists, fewer records and texts for historians, and fewer trinkets, large and small, to fill museum exhibits," end quote. But he argued that such vacant periods represented a bolt for freedom by many state subjects and an improvement in human welfare. Anarchic social orders erect no monuments and leave no ruins to be bleached over the centuries in the desert sand. Instead, they offer alternative visions of how society might have developed had states not formed, concentrating manpower and crops, homogenizing landscapes, and taming rivers. Some critics have called Scott a romantic, in part for seeming to indulge the lawlessness of non-state peoples. In Against the Grain and The Art of Not Being Governed, there is an ineluctable charisma to the frontier nomads with their state-repelling egalitarianism and their sense of freedom. In Praise of Floods extends the forms of resistance Scott celebrates to non-human subjects. Laboring to evoke the sheer variety of what gets lost when rivers are subjugated by humans, he devotes a questionable chapter to ventriloquizing the voices of riverine animals, mollusks, river dolphins, a snow carp, Asian hairy-nosed otters, speaking out against human intervention. But his work, even at its most tendentious, speaks uncannily to our current political mood of gnawing anxiety, fleeting optimism, and partial resignation over the future of the human project. To read Scott is to feel the fatalistic sense that civilization may have been botched from the beginning. But it is also to be hopeful that what seems to be a runaway ecological crisis and a global drift toward authoritarianism contains within it the potential for political transformation, if you look closely enough. At Scott's memorial service last October, organizers handed out tote bags with the slogan, "Become ungovernable." Disobedience was, in certain respects, the watchword of all of his work. In Two Cheers for Anarchism, a short book published in 2012, he testifies, like a latter-day Henry David Thoreau, to insubordination as an animating principle of all social change. He describes the desertion of Confederate soldiers during the Civil War as potentially a key factor in the overthrow of slavery, and even lauds the Vietnam War-era practice of fragging, in which infantrymen supposedly used live grenades to eliminate their commanding officers. Authoritarianism, in Scott's view, dies this way, not through revolutionary vanguards or rioting mobs, but through the silent, dogged resistance, withdrawal, and truculence of millions of ordinary people. Just as millions of anathosoan polyps create willy-nilly a coral reef, he writes, so do thousands upon thousands of acts of insubordination and evasion create an economic or political barrier reef of their own. Next, from the book section of the April 14th, 2025 issue, environmentalists are rethinking nuclear. Should they? 14 years after the Fukushima disaster, nuclear power is being rebranded as a climate savior, and fission is in fashion, by Elizabeth Colbert. The disaster at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant began on the afternoon of March 11, 2011, when the Tohoku earthquake, also known as the Great East Japan Earthquake and the Great Sendai Earthquake, struck the island of Honshu. The shock, which registered 9.1 on the Richter scale, was so powerful that it knocked the island 8 feet closer to Hawaii and generated a tsunami that sloshed all the way to Antarctica. That afternoon, 3 of Fukushima's 6 reactors were up and running. The other 3 were down for maintenance. The quake tripped the plant's emergency response system, and control rods were automatically inserted into the fuel assemblies in the units numbered 1, 2, and 3. Even so, the reactors continued to give off heat. When the tsunami hit about 45 minutes later, it flooded the plant's backup generators, along with the batteries that were supposed to back up the backups. As a result, Fukushima's cooling pumps failed. Within hours, the temperature inside Unit 1 rose to 5,000 degrees, and the fuel assembly started to melt down. Everyone living within a mile and a half of the plant was ordered to evacuate. Setback followed setback, in what one report would refer to as a chain reaction of crises. On March 12th, exploding hydrogen destroyed much of Unit 1 and exposed the pool that housed spent fuel rods to the air. The evacuation zone was extended to 6 miles, then, later that day, to 12 miles. Workers at the plant tried frantically to contain the damage by, for example, spraying seawater from fire hoses and rigging up car batteries to supply power. On March 13th, the fuel assembly in Unit 3 melted. On March 14th, that unit suffered an explosion. On March 15th, there was another explosion, this time in Unit 4, where highly radioactive waste was being stored. The reactor's containment domes remained intact. As radiation dose rates soared, Fukushima's owner, the Tokyo Power Company, considered pulling its workers from the plant. The Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, met with aides to assess the consequences of such a move. They concluded that without workers, the situation would spin further out of control, and that eventually all of Tokyo, which is 150 miles south of Fukushima, might have to be emptied. Kan grew so alarmed that, reportedly, he stormed into TEPCO's offices to demand that the workers stay at their post. "What the hell is going on?" he asked, according to press accounts. In the immediate aftermath, the lesson of Fukushima seemed clear. On March 15th, Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, announced a shutdown of the seven oldest of the country's 17 working reactors. "The absolutely improbable became reality," Merkel, who had previously been staunchly pro-nuclear, said. "That changes the situation." A few weeks later, her government decided to decommission all of Germany's nuclear facilities. In short order, Switzerland, Belgium, and Japan announced phase-out plans. In earthquake-prone Italy, which had already shuttered its reactors, voters overwhelmingly rejected a government proposal to allow new ones to be constructed. "I am really happy," one Roman voter told Reuters. "We do not want nuclear plants." But with time, the accident's significance has faded. When, in 2023, Germany fulfilled Merkel's promise and shut down the last of its reactors, her successor as head of the Christian Democratic Union, Friedrich Merz, mourned the event, calling it a black day. "It raises the question of who here is driving in the wrong direction," Merz said. By now, Switzerland, Belgium, and Japan have all backed away from their phase-out goals. Many countries, including Canada, France, and the United States, have signed on to a pledge to triple global nuclear capacity by 2050. Google has teamed up with a nuclear startup called Kairos Power. Amazon is investing in another nuclear startup, X Energy. Microsoft wants to reopen a shuttered reactor at Three Mile Island in central Pennsylvania. 14 years after Fukushima, fission, for better or worse, is back in fashion. Rebecca Tahus-Dubrow, a freelance journalist who was brought up in the 1990s on whole wheat sandwiches packed in reused paper bags. Her environmentalist parents oppose nuclear power and might well have marched at anti-nuclear protests had the U.S. not mostly given up building reactors by then. Influenced by what she calls years of indoctrination, she became worried about environmental problems, particularly climate change. As an adult in Southern California, she helped organize her neighbors to install solar panels. She still viewed nuclear skeptically until she learned that some prominent climate scientists were calling it the world's best hope for limiting warming. Could it really be true that something that had once threatened to doom us was now needed to save us? She wondered. She set out to learn more and chronicles her journey of discovery in Atomic Dreams, The New Nuclear Evangelists and the Fight for the Future of Energy, published by Algonquin. Prominent among the book's evangelists are Heather Hoff and Christian Zeitz, who founded a group called Mothers for Nuclear. The organization's logo shows a mother cradling a baby encircled by rings of electrons. Hoff and Zeitz both work at the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant in Central California. They are athletic and adventurous, and Tahus-Dubrow clearly admires them. The two women seem like more outdoorsy and capable versions of me, the kind of person I sort of wished I were, she writes. But recognizing that they are being paid by the nuclear industry, she also tries to maintain her repertorial distance. I knew to be cautious about accepting their claims at face value. As it happened, Hoff was in the control room at Diablo Canyon the day of the Great East Japan earthquake. According to Tahus-Dubrow, Hoff's initial reaction to the meltdowns was much like everyone else's. Her confidence in nuclear power was shaken. Gradually, though, Hoff recovered her faith. Yes, every nuclear operator's nightmare had come true at Fukushima, but what had been the actual consequences? No one living close to the plant or anyone working inside it had died from acute radiation syndrome. As the years passed, there was no discernible rise in cancer deaths in the area around Fukushima. Meanwhile, a great many people, it's been estimated at more than 2,000, had died prematurely as a result of the disruptions caused by the evacuations. Most of these victims were sick or elderly or both. On the Mothers for Nuclear website, Hoff eventually summarized her view as follows. Our fears were largely misdirected. In her travels with nuclear evangelist, Tuhus de Bro hears versions of this argument over and over. The problem is not that nuclear plants are prone to catastrophic meltdowns. It's that people are prone to catastrophic thinking. You see time and time again that fear of radiation, fear of nuclear, has been more dangerous than nuclear itself. Eric Meyer, a former opera singer who heads a group called Generation Atomic, tells her. Much of Atomic Dreams is devoted to the plant that employs Hoffenzeitz. This is partly a function of Diablo Canyon's location. It's the only working nuclear station in Tuhus de Bro's home state, and partly a function of its history. No nuclear facility in the U.S., and perhaps none in the world, has been the subject of more wrangling. The fight began all the way back in 1961 when Pacific Gas and Electric proposed siting a nuclear reactor in Bodega Bay, a fishing village north of San Francisco, which Alfred Hitchcock once described as picturesque. He shot the birds there. At that point, the Sierra Club had yet to take a position on nuclear power, but it opposed PG&E's plan out of concerns that cooling towers would mar the scenery. PG&E then proposed moving the plant 300 miles south to the Napoma Dunes. This was where Cecil B. DeMille had filmed The Ten Commandments, and the Sierra Club objected again for similar reasons. The Diablo Canyon site, a bluff on the Pacific roughly halfway between San Francisco and L.A., was also spectacular. This time around, the Sierra Club was willing to compromise. In 1966, its executive board declared the bluff a satisfactory alternative. Ground was broken on Unit 1 2 years later. In 1969, geologists discovered the Hoskri Fault just offshore from Diablo Canyon. Mothers for Peace, a San Luis Obispo group originally formed to protest the Vietnam War, swiveled to take on PG&E. The organization filed motion after motion aimed at halting construction. This slowed but did not stop the work. Then, in 1979, Three Mile Island's Unit 2 suffered a partial meltdown. The ranks of the Diablo Canyon's opponents swelled. In 1981, protesters blocked the only paved access road to the plant. Within 2 weeks, more than 1,900 people were arrested. Diablo Canyon Unit 1 finally went online in May 1985. Unit 2 followed in March 1986. A month later, the number 4 reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in northern Ukraine melted down and caught fire. Mothers for Peace members took to wearing badges that said, "Remember Chernobyl, it can happen here." For the next couple of decades, the Mothers kept fighting and Diablo Canyon kept operating, more or less uneventfully. This was the case even though several additional earthquake faults were discovered nearby. All the while, though, the glow was coming off the atom. Nuclear power had been promoted as affordable, according to one famous prediction it would be too cheap to meter, but was instead proving too expensive to sustain. By contrast, other forms of energy, such as solar and wind, were falling steeply in price. In 2016, PG&E announced that it would close Diablo Canyon when the reactor's operating licenses expired in 2025. The utility promised to replace the power with other forms of carbon-free energy. Governor Gavin Newsom called the arrangement one we can all be proud of. It was around the time of this announcement that Hoffenzeitz founded Mothers for Nuclear. The duo thought shuttering the plant was a terrible idea, and not just, they insisted, because it would cost them their jobs. Conceived as a foil to Mothers for Peace, Mothers for Nuclear adopted many of the older group's tactics. Protesting, testifying at hearings, offering up catchy slogans, in this case ones like "Split, don't emit." And, as with Mothers for Peace, they were initially at least frustrated. But then yet came another turn of the turbine. In the summer of 2020, California experienced a brutal heat wave. The demand for air conditioning strained the state's power grid, and the grid's operator, which goes by the acronym CAISO, CAISO, instituted rolling blackouts. Diablo Canyon was then providing almost 10% of the state's electricity, and despite the terms PG&E had agreed to, it seemed likely that if the plant shut down, at least some of the power it generated would be replaced by burning fossil fuels. In February 2022, more than 75 energy and climate experts sent a letter to Newsom, who by then had become the governor, urging him to delay the closure of the plant. A few months later, Newsom, in effect, ripped up the deal to decommission the plant. "Some would say it's the righteous and right climate decision," he told the Los Angeles Times. What struck Tuhus DeBrow most about the reaction to the governor's reversal was that there wasn't much of one. Mothers for Peace, which was still actively opposing Diablo Canyon, was furious, of course, she reports, but the general public sentiment seemed to be a shrug. Late last year, after Atomic Dreams went to press, California's Public Utilities Board approved a rate hike that is expected to increase the total price of electricity in the state by more than $700 million. The hike was explicitly designed to cover the cost of Diablo Canyon's continuing operation. Marco Visscher is a Dutch journalist whose backstory resembles Tuhus DeBrow's. He once declared that the technology had nothing good to bring to people or nature, and that now is the time to bring the nuclear industry down. But he kept hearing about environmentalists and climate scientists who were staunchly pro-nuclear. He decided to look into the matter, and in the process experienced a full-blown conversion. In The Power of Nuclear, published by Bloomsbury Sigma, he declares, "Just about everything we think we know about nuclear power turns out to be wrong. Our first and most important mistake, according to Visscher, is thinking that nuclear power represents a special threat. Every form of energy production poses risks. Coal-fired power plants belch out pollutants that cause, among many other health problems, lung disease, heart disease, and cancer. A study published in The Lancet estimated that coal on a per kilowatt basis was nearly 500 times deadlier than nuclear. Though gas-fired plants burn cleaner, they too emit dangerous particulates. Renewables, meanwhile, pose hazards of their own. Hydroelectric dams collapse. Small planes fly into wind turbines. Nuclear power is the safest of all energy sources," Visscher asserts. So how did it get such a bad rep? In Visscher's telling, the problem paradoxically stems from the industry's tireless pursuit of safety. In the U.S., reactors operate under the requirement that radiation doses for workers and the public be kept as low as is reasonably achievable, for short, ALARA. The nuclear industry accepted this requirement in the 1970s in an attempt to reassure the public, Visscher writes, but it didn't work. It only reinforced the idea that any exposure was too much. If the industry itself treated very low doses of radiation with the utmost care, it must be dangerous, right? Another big mistake is the fear of nuclear waste. When spent fuel rods are first removed from a reactor, they are extremely hot in terms of both temperature and radioactivity. Although in the first sense they will cool down in a matter of years, in the second they will remain hazardous for centuries. In the U.S., the Department of Energy has been trying for nearly five decades to draft a plan for the long-term storage of nuclear waste, but has yet to come up with one that can win congressional approval. As a result, 100,000 tons worth of spent fuel has piled up at reactors around the country. 2,000 additional tons are added each year. Disposal has been called the nuclear industry's Achilles heel. Here again, Visscher waves away concerns. Solutions exist, he says. They just have to be implemented. Finland is currently building a deep geological repository for its waste. The repository on the country's southwestern coast will eventually consist of 30 miles of tunnels bored into the granite bedrock. Spent fuel can also be recycled or, to use the term of art, reprocessed. This is done in, among other countries, France. Finally, in what are known as fast reactors, waste can be converted into fuel. The highly radioactive waste from nuclear plants is special indeed, but in a good way, Visscher writes. Among climate scientists, the most outspoken proponent of nuclear power is probably James Hansen, a former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who is sometimes called the father of global warming. Anson recently co-wrote an op-ed in the Albany Times-Union that praised New York's Governor Kathy Hochul for embracing advanced nuclear as a way to cut the state's greenhouse gas emissions. If the state hopes to achieve its climate goals, it will need more nuclear power, the article concluded. Fisher presents climate change as the ultimate pro-nuclear argument. Industrialized economies need reliable electricity, and the sun and the wind provide power only intermittently. Those who disagree with him are, he suggests, either hypocrites or dupes. This group includes the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who says that nuclear plants take too long to build, and the former European Commissioner for Climate Action Frans Timmermans, who says that they're too expensive. Delays and cost overruns aren't reasons to oppose nuclear power, Fisher counters. They are products of the opposition to nuclear power, which can add years and billions of dollars to construction. Nuclear foes have, quote, turned out to be the useful idiots of the fossil fuel industry, he writes. Were those who opposed nuclear power wrong to do so? As Marco Fisher points out, all forms of energy production entail risk. And as James Hansen points out, the risk, or really the certainty, of continuing to burn fossil fuels is global catastrophe. Major cities underwater, grain belts too hot to produce grain, forests in flames, entire ecosystems unraveling. Clearly, the new nuclear evangelists have a point. Just as clearly, they're also missing something. Say what you will, Fukushima was a world-class disaster. Hundreds of tons of highly radioactive fuel are still sitting at the bottoms of Units 1, 2, and 3 because no one knows what to do with them or even how to get at them. Cleaning up the site could take a century, if it happens at all. And the really chilling part is that a much bigger accident was averted only by accident. Because Unit 4 was undergoing maintenance when the tsunami hit, workers had filled its reactor well with water. Owing to a leak that should not have existed, some of this water seeped into the unit's spent fuel pool. It's likely that without this leak, the hot fuel rods in the pool would have caught fire. In that case, radionuclides would have been spewed over a wide area, possibly including Tokyo. A high-ranking Japanese official called this possibility the devil's scenario. Nuclear power, and this includes burying or reprocessing the resulting waste, has always been safe on paper. The trouble is that we don't live on paper. We live in a world where earthquake faults are belatedly discovered, contractors cut corners, utilities mislaid, regulators and people panic. A world, in short, of errors, terrors, and corruption. As the world warms, global instability will only increase. In this sense, climate change represents a pretty good argument against going nuclear. In the end, the most convincing case for learning to love fission may be the grimmest, not so much green as dark green. Few nuclearists embrace it, but it did have one influential advocate, James Lovelock, the British scientist best known for developing the Gaia hypothesis. Lovelock, writing in 2001, observed that the bubonic plague presented a great threat to medieval Europeans, but was, quote, of no consequence for the earth itself, end quote. Much the same could be said of nuclear accidents. They are traumatic for the human beings involved, but have little appreciable effect on the biosphere. The land around the failed Chernobyl power station was evacuated because its high radiation intensity made it unsafe for people. Lovelock, who died in 2022, wrote on his 103rd birthday. But this radioactive land is now rich in wildlife, much more so than neighboring populated areas. We call the ash from nuclear power nuclear waste and worry about its safe disposal. I wonder if instead we should use it as an incorruptible guardian of the beautiful places of the earth. Who would dare cut down a forest in which was the storage place of nuclear ash? Next, a poem from the April 14th issue, What I Meant to Say Was, by Sophie Cabot Black. Let the house burn again. Already I outlive the new world. The last dog dead. One cow, remnant, in the gleaming wind. Of leaf fall and each child left for elsewhere. To stay past those I buried, I do not know what more to spend. The government of man, by man, brings no one home. No longer do I want to be upon this hill, this place of so much wind, where I keep writing past the end. I have broken each sentence, halved, then half again. Each word simpled down like old oxen, kept as if to cover the whole field, turn by turn. Now the words come less, the clouds so fast, and not what I thought I thought. For what have I survived to save each house, a door sprung open, plain, willing each hinge to work, verse by verse to outlast, outlove whatever it is you bring forth. Finally, a poem in the April 7th, 2025 issue, Refusal by Cynthia Ozick, written in memoriam of Laure Segal, 1928-2024. Acclaim nature's hues in fall and spring, gold and rust, lilac and rose, azaleas aflame, petal and leaf conspiring in unbelief that by and by they and I must come in grief to dust. Refuse to seed in shame what nature sows and choose what leaf and petal and wayward weed all know. Grow. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.